Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is the day after the Massachusetts primary and the first one in this pandemic. Now, most of the results have come in, but we're still waiting to hear about the 4th Congressional District, where Brookline Selectwoman Jessie Mermel and Newton City Councilor Jake Auchincloss are neck and neck in their quest to succeed Congressman Joe Kennedy. Secretary of the Commonwealth Bill Galvin just recently announced in the last little bit that he's seeking a court to authorize local election officials to continue counting a number of ballots in that race, including mail-in votes. We will talk about that more later in the show, but let's focus right now on one of the night's biggest moments and the reason Kennedy's seat is open. Incumbent Senator Ed Markey successfully fought off a challenge from Congressman Joe Kennedy. Here's Markey speaking to reporters earlier today.
There's an old saying in Massachusetts politics that it's great to have young people behind you, but they just don't vote in Massachusetts. Well, we put that old saw to rest yesterday.
Here for more is WBUR's Anthony Brooks. Welcome, Anthony.
Hi, Tiziana.
So let's jump right to it. Why did Markey win?
Well, I mean, I think he touched on a point there talking about those young people. They voted in big numbers yesterday, and it really helped fuel Markey's victory over Kennedy by more than 10 points. I think Markey also did a really good job of sort of casting himself as a progressive in this moment when progressivism, especially in Massachusetts, especially in a Massachusetts Democratic primary, really carries a lot of weight. And his alliance with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez really cast him as that progressive. On the other side, you know, it was up to Joe Kennedy to really make a case why Markey should be fired. And I think for a lot of voters, he just didn't do that.
So let me ask you, a lot of incumbents won last night, Anthony. So what does that do to this idea that this is about youth insurgency?
Well, I mean, arguably in Markey's case, the youth and progressivism and all those progressive political groups from the Sunrise Movement, people who care about the agenda put forth by Ocasio-Cortez, I mean, it was fueled by progressive energy in a lot of ways. But if you're talking about Richie Neal out in the first congressional district where he was challenged by Alex Morse, you know, the progressives didn't carry the day out there. And yeah, one of the big storylines from last night is all the incumbents across Massachusetts, all the members of Congress and the Senate won their primaries. So, in that sense, incumbency won, progressivism upsetting the apple cart, not so much.
All right, WBUR's Anthony Brooks, I know you're going to stay with us for most of the show. So sit tight if you would for a minute, please, because for more reaction, I want to now turn to someone with personal experience, both running in a congressional primary and working with the mail. That's Congressman Bill Keating. He represents the Massachusetts 9th Congressional District. And early in his career, he worked as a mail carrier for the U.S. Postal Service. Congressman Keating, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Tiziana, it's great to be with you again. And thanks for all you're doing to enlighten people. We're going to need it during these critical times ahead.
Well, thank you for being here, and let's do it together, and let's start with the results from yesterday. You served in the House with Ed Markey before he became a senator. You endorsed him in the race. You also right now serve with Joe Kennedy. What's your reaction to yesterday's outcome?
Well, there'll be people analyzing this in political science classes, for years to come, I think. But in the last analysis, you had two candidates, both of whom were very close to each other on issues. And so you look to the other issues of how their candidates, how they frame their races rather than the substance. And I think that there is something to be said about the fact that if you're going to challenge an incumbent, you have to set a case at the outset, not just why you could win, but also why you're better than them. And that didn't happen early on. It happened as the campaign developed. And that may well have been a factor, but I think people will be analyzing who voted. Now, there were an awful lot of new first-time voters, according to the Secretary of State, and that's going to be an interesting, change in what we had before, because younger voters did lag, and if they indeed were the first-time voters, it's going to be something that's very good for our democracy, to have people with so much at stake. And I think, younger people understand that now. You know, I had Greta Thunberg to my committee, and the response we got from college students, high school students, younger people was enormous when she was a witness in front of my committee. And, you know, there's an example of her galvanizing one of the three existential issues we have in front of us right now, climate change.
So just to clarify for listeners, that's Greta Thunberg, the global environmental activist who has been global since her teenage years as a young adult.
That's right. We have trouble with her name sometimes because she pronounces it Greta Thornberry.
I can't do it. I'm doing my best, though.
She's extraordinary as a person. I really was very impressed with her and the young people that went and joined her in that hearing, including a conservative Republican student as well. So it showed a coming together and a generational understanding of just how serious the climate change issue is. And I think that was part of this campaign as well.
I want to stay on young people for a minute, because in this first Massachusetts primary in this pandemic, many first-time voters, which you would assume many young voters are, got to vote by mail. And in fact, Secretary Galvin, as of September 1st, said that we had received 850,000 mail-in ballots in this primary. I know that this is something you've thought a lot about. Your service as a postal carrier makes it sit home with you. Are you confident that the USPS has handled what it could in the last 24 hours and will be able to handle a mail-in election in November?
Well, I think it's two different questions. I think largely they were able to handle this primary in Massachusetts currently. However, with the increase in voting this fall in November and what's happening to the Postal Service right now in terms of cutting back on overtime, in terms of taking mail sorters that can just sort mail at tremendous rates of speed, pulling back on some of the actual mail receptacles, these things will have an effect. And I don't think they were fully pronounced in terms of yesterday's primary, but I'm very concerned going into November because we're having hearings, we're not getting answers, and we're hearing different things. We're hearing from postal workers themselves about these issues, and then you had the testimony of Postmaster DeJoy with a whole different tune.
So, Congressman Keating, let's stay on Postmaster General DeJoy for a minute. He has overseen many of the changes that you just described. He has suspended the changes that he was making to the USPS until after November, but many have criticized him for not rolling back changes that had already happened. Is him suspending what he's doing until after November far enough in your view?
No, it isn't. In fact, his qualifications, frankly, and his actions call his own ability to assume that position into question in my mind. The issue that we have in front of us, this is just not a democratic issue. This is a healthcare issue. People will vote. And do we want to really have people? I represent outside of Florida, I've been told, the oldest district demographically of any congressional district in the country. Now, people that are older, people with pre-existing conditions, they're endangering their health in particular to a disproportionate effect. Going out to exercise the democratic rights. This shouldn't just be viewed purely as a voting issue. It's a healthcare issue.
So I want to ask, what about legitimate concerns about fiscal health of the USPS? I mean, we know that there have been concerns for a long time. How do those get sorted out when these are the stakes?
The two things aren't. I think during the testimony of Postmaster DeJoy, he tried to create a false narrative. He tried to say, well, the Postal Service needs change, so that's why I had to take these actions at this time. The two things aren't contradictory. We're in a healthcare pandemic right now, and there is a difference. Now, the longer-term issues of the post office, including a change in the pension, the way pensions are calculated, going 75 years forward, which is unusual for any business, did create a crisis. And there's issues of modernization. There's issues of trying to expand, I think, the services that are offered by the post office. And realizing, too, at the end of the day, it's a service. Now, there's portions of it that are money-making. There's portions of it that aren't. If this was privatized, as people like the administration try to use as an example, they would not serve those areas where it wasn't profit-making. And it's a service that brings our country together. So if you're in a rural area, if you're in an area where it wouldn't make economic sense to have deliveries, well, you wouldn't get service under the direction that they want to take us. That is not what the Postal Service was created to do.
I'd like to talk about the safety of voting via mail for a minute. We've got a yin and yang here. There was a report in the New York Post over the weekend citing an anonymous source claiming to have participated in mail-in voter fraud. On the other hand, the FBI came out last week and said there's no evidence of any coordinated fraud schemes related to voting by mail this year. What does this there is or there isn't tension about voter fraud and conversation about the legitimacy of mail-in votes do for our elections, and how can Congress keep the voting by mail safe?
Anonymous anecdotal information, probably spun by the same people that wore such dark clothes into the plane that President Trump talked about yesterday, they're fiction.
You're referring to his conspiracy about people
are.
On a plane who were looters and rioters?
There's a conspiracy theory, too, exactly. And there's a conspiracy theory about mail fraud. We have entire states that have had voted by mail for years and years. They've been analyzed. In fact, the president started with a commission to look into voter fraud, and they disbanded it because they couldn't find any. So, again, just like with the healthcare issue that we're dealing with, the COVID-19 issue, there's facts and there's fiction. And this administration is dealing in fiction and not facts. And just as it's important to deal with healthcare facts to guide us in terms of what action should we take, we should take in terms of policy, the same holds true for our elections. So the facts tell us that this is not an issue. It's done to create distrust in the elections. And frankly, on another front where our elections are being jeopardized and more information is coming from just breaking in the last day or two from the Homeland Secretary that his chief of staff withheld information about a Russian attack. Just as that's the case attacking our elections, causing doubt. That's what Russia's attempt originally was to do, to cast doubt on our democracy. And to hear the President of the United States talk about the fact that this election's rigged before we have it, that mail fraud is going to be so rampant that any result will be rigged, plays right into Putin's hands and undercuts the thread that holds us together as a democracy.
Congressman, I know your time is limited, so in our last 30 seconds or so, with that still ringing in our ears, and knowing that this is an important, for all parties, important general election in November, what's your message right now to the voters of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
My message is this. There'll be opportunities to cast your vote in many ways. One of the ways that I think could be much better utilized and much safer, when you get your absentee ballot, when you get your mail-in ballot, you can fill that out, and all the town clerks and city clerks will have receptacles prior to the election. So you don't have to necessarily mail it in. You can be out and just drop it in. Check with your local town clerks. You'll be able to do this, and that'll ease the crunch of the mail and ensure your votes are there.
That's Congressman Bill Keating, who represents the Massachusetts 9th Congressional District. Thanks for joining us today, Congressman. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
So turning back to WBUR's Anthony Brooks, who's still with us and was listening into that conversation. Anthony, first, just what are your reactions?
Well, I mean, what you heard from the congressman is a case for defeating Donald Trump. And that's what a lot of Democrats are focused on in a big way. And, getting back to Senator Markey, that's certainly what he was talking about today in Boston as sort of where his focus is now. He's going to be going up against Republican attorney Kevin O'Connor on the November 3rd general election. And it's not unprecedented, Tiziana, as you know, that a Republican can win a Senate seat in Massachusetts. Scott Brown did it in 2010. But I think the feeling is, especially given the energy that Markey created among young people and progressives, he's got a pretty easy roll toward November 3rd.
And so, Anthony, what happens for Joe Kennedy now? And is there a loss for the Commonwealth in not having the two of them still in Washington?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, I heard that frustration expressed by voters along the way. And this sort of gets back to why Markey won and why Kennedy lost, because people often told me, you know, I like them both. I wish they could both be going to Washington. It's too bad I have to make a choice. But at the end of the day, and I think the congressman made the point, it's not enough just to say, this is why I'd be a good senator. You have to make a case about why you want to chuck the other guy out. And I think Kennedy didn't quite do that. I thought his case got stronger as his campaign went on, and by the time he was offering his concession speech last night, talking about working class folks who have the weight of economic insecurity on their shoulders, I thought that was quite an eloquent statement about why he was running. But you know, Markey clearly had the upper hand and thought and had sort of placed himself among the progressives and was fueled by that young energy. As for what happens next to Kennedy, it was interesting to listen to Markey today because, of course, this was a hard-fought and sometimes bitter campaign. But today in Boston, Markey paid tribute to the Kennedy family. Here's a little bit of what he said.
The Kennedy family has served the Commonwealth and our nation with distinction for generations. I revere their legacy and what they have done for our state and our country. I was inspired by a call to service by President Kennedy.
So, Tiziana, you know, get back to your question about what happens next for Joe Kennedy. You know, there's been already lots of writing about the end of the Kennedy dynasty, and it is true. He's the first Kennedy to lose in Massachusetts, but I don't think he's going away. He's still young. He's still talented. And I was thinking today of Andrew Cuomo. He lost a really disappointing, for him, a governor's race and then sort of disappeared. And a lot of people said, that's it. The Cuomo legacy is over in New York. But then he came back, ran for attorney general. Then he ran for governor and has been reelected twice. So I could imagine Joe Kennedy coming back, running for attorney general. If Maura Healey ends up running for governor one day, that opens up an opportunity for him. I don't think we've seen the last of Joe Kennedy III.
Okay, Anthony, I know you're going to stay with us, so we're going to go to a break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about yesterday's results, looking at campaign strategies and what we can learn for future races. That's what's next. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. A lot changed ahead of this primary election. The pandemic, mail-in voting, a national reckoning on racial justice. And that means campaigns had to adapt too, fast and real time. So what worked and what didn't? And what lessons could political strategists take away from some of the big congressional races this year? Still with us is WBUR political reporter Anthony Brooks. Welcome back, Anthony.
Hey, thanks, Tiziana.
And two additional guests join us for this deep dive into a few of the Democratic primary races in the state and what we can learn from them. First, we have Marcella Garcia. She's an editorial writer for the Boston Globe. Welcome, Marcella.
Having me.
Also with us is Scott Ferson, Democratic strategist, president of the Liberty Square Group. He's also a paid consultant on Ed Markey's campaign. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so about two-thirds of the votes this time were supposedly cast before Election Day. We heard that 850,000 number from Secretary Galvin on the 1st. How did that change this election? Marcella, let me have you jump in first.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest takeaways from this election, that it had to be a pandemic to sort of spur this electoral reform that, you know, people for years have been asking, mail-in voting. And it served, I think, as a dry run for making it permanent. I think it was a huge success. You know, the record is going to be broken, likely. Right now, it's more than 1.6 million people casting votes statewide. And I think it shows that when you remove barriers to voting, when you make it easier for people to vote, people vote. When you put a ballot in people's hands, they exercise their right to vote. And I think that's pretty powerful. It's a pretty powerful statement. And I think it makes it's so much more compelling to pursue further electoral reforms like same day voting registration or making it a holiday, you know, voting day, or moving it to a weekend. What's interesting to me is that, you know, we saw this huge turnout because there was a contested Senate race, and it was because Joe Kennedy decided to challenge Senator Markey. And I think that's obviously what drove the turnout. But the pandemic definitely showed you know, it's I think it's a good, it's sort of a silver lining, right? That we can do this, that we can do mail-in voting in a safe, relatively easy and calm way. I did not see major disruptions or problems. And I think that shows why we need to make it permanent.
So let me ask about that, Scott. Marcella just said that's why we need to make it permanent. Do you think it will be?
Well, I think it's less scary now. I mean, our elected officials make the election laws. And I think there's a certain amount of unease with change because they were elected under the present rules. And then when you say we're going to open it up, I'm sure there's a lot of skepticism of what that exactly means. And it wasn't scary at all. In fact, you know, there was a pretty good mandate for incumbents here so I agree with Marcella that it worked. You know, it could have been complicated. It could have been hard for cities and towns to process it, but it wasn't. And the vote came in fairly efficiently. And we're even seeing that play out in the fourth in a very, very tight race. I think the other thing that makes it a success, and I didn't think about it actually until one of my interns who's a college student mentioned it to me in a race that they were working with for a governor's council race with a first-time candidate who got 70,000 votes, is that they heard a lot of people who said, I got my ballot and I sat down at the kitchen table and I Googled all the names. And normally in voting, you have to kind of do your research first and you come in with a little slip of paper or you try to remember. And if you see a down ballot race and you don't know who they are, you skip it. And here, I think people spent more time with their ballots. And that's actually an excellent way for democracy to flourish and be in form an electorate. And so I think for those two reasons, it will be permanent.
And Anthony, in your reporting and talking to voters, is there a hunger for that, this scale of mail-in voting from here on out?
You know, I'm not sure that I had an opportunity to really put that question to a lot of voters, but I think I agree with a lot of what's been said. I mean, we should also point out that mail-in voting has been used. I mean, Massachusetts was relatively slow to this game. There were Western states, and by the way, predominantly red states, that have been doing it for years. So this idea that mail-in voting is some, you know, dangerous threat to democracy and inviting fraud that's coming from the White House, for example, this is a relatively recent notion. You know, critics see it as a pretty obvious play toward voter suppression. But, you know, the one thing I would say is that, or I guess I'd say two things about last night. It seemed to go incredibly smoothly, but we do have a very close race in the Massachusetts 4th in the Democratic primary there. And I'm reading that the Secretary of the Commonwealth, William Galvin, is asking a court to authorize local election officials to continue counting state primary ballots that were received on time but had not been tallied as of the end of last night. And that's due to the volume of the mail-in ballots. And it's also due to the fact that existing state law lacks procedures, I'm understanding, for counting of state primary ballots after Election Day. It's worth bringing that up because you could just imagine if in Massachusetts we're facing this moment and it could have consequences on the counting of ballots in the 4th Congressional District. Imagine if this is happening on a big scale after November 3rd, and you've got White House lawyers demanding recounts and doing all kinds of stuff around mail-in ballots in battleground states where, you know, upon which might hang the outcome of the election. That's the only thing that scares me. It's not a knock against mail-in voting. It's just like it's uncharted territory. And in this time of huge political division, it does worry me.
And just to illustrate that for listeners, the top two vote getters so far in the fourth, Jesse Mermel and Jake Auchincloss, in reports, you know, just a couple of hours ago, they were about 500 votes apart with not all the votes in yet. So we are talking close. I want to talk campaign strategy here. Let's look at the Markey and Kennedy campaigns. And what I'd like to do with the three of you is a free for all. So please jump in, talk to each other back and forth. We're on a little bit of a sound delay because we're in three different places. But I want to hear from all of you about the good, the bad, and the ugly of campaign strategy in these two campaigns. Jump on in.
You mean
or
just,
Marcella?
Yeah, go
can
ahead.
Go first.
Marcella, you go first, Marcella.
All right, the good. I think the good is, again, I think it's always good to have a raise. A lot of people resented the fact that Joe Kennedy decided to go after Senator Ed Markey. But I think at the end of the day, you want to test, to challenge, you know, your elected officials. And in this case, Senator Markey more than rose to the challenge, and to his immense credit, he decided that he wanted to stay a senator, and he went out and fought for it. So I think that was a good outcome. You know, everyone, I think, gained from this process. You know, we had a record turnout. That would not have happened if there, you know, if there hadn't been a statewide race. So I think that's, you know, that's one good. The bad, I think, you know, this, I mean, it's not bad or ugly. It's just like this whole chatter about ranked choice voting is very confusing in the context of the 4th congressional race. Obviously, we need ranked choice voting. There's no question. We need it before this race. We need it after. But the way some observers are using the 4th as an example, yes, you definitely, in a wide open race with 9 or more candidates, ranked choice voting is the most effective way to, you know, to get at what people really want, most people in the district really want. So, but if ranked choice voting is in place, campaigns are run different, races are run differently. So I think it's misguided, I think, not bad or ugly, but it's misguided to apply this lesson of, oh, if we had ranked choice voting in the 4th, so-and-so would have won, because that's not how, I don't think that's how it would have worked. The idea,
Marcella, being that there were a whole bunch of progressives who kind of occupied the same lane and they may have forced
correct.
Each other kind of out.
Correct. But even within the progressives, there were shades of progressiveness. There were shades of Democrats, right? So everyone sort of lumped together the progressives against Jake. But even within the progressives, like, you know, maybe saying Lecky vote, you know, maybe a second vote. It's not guaranteed that the second vote of a Lysane Lecky vote would have gone to Mermel or Linos. You know, you just don't know. People rank their choices in a very different way. You know, some might go by policy, some might go by likability. And this is why when you have ranked choice voting, campaigns are run differently. You know, people are not as negative. It's just the whole dynamic changes. So I think it's a good lesson, but let's not overthinking.
And just to note for voters, that is a ballot item in November. Ranked choice voting is here in Massachusetts. Scott and Anthony, let me give you a chance to react, build off of there. Tell us a little bit more about campaign strategies that were effective this year.
I'd like to focus on the good as well, because I think there was a lot of good. And we've talked a little bit about the mail-in voting. I think in the Markey Kennedy race, first of all, I think they end the race both with very high favorability ratings. Voters, and I see this in polling, like them both, even though the focus was sort of on the contention between the camps. So they think highly of them, and I think generally do for elected officials on the statewide ballot in Massachusetts. But I think I like democracy. And so even though I was working for Senator Markey, I like the fact that that democracy was exercised and there was a challenge. I worked for Senator Kennedy in 1994, and I think he was a more attentive senator after 94, cemented his legacy in the 15 years from 94 until his death and made him the line of the Senate. And I think Markey, particularly if the Democrats take the Senate and Biden is elected, is poised, even though he doesn't have seniority in the Senate, but it becomes a very, very powerful senator in terms of the things that he articulated in what I thought was an excellent victory speech last night. And I think we'll see a different Ed Markey. The other thing I think, too, and John Walsh, who gets a lot of credit, I think, for the win last night, the campaign manager, said early on, you know, I think people at the end of this will say, I didn't know that about Ed Markey. And I think now voters in Massachusetts have a broad appreciation for the depth of his legislative accomplishments and what he's done over his tenure. And quickly on the 4th, I look at the results and everyone's focusing on the top two. But I just want to point out that if you add the votes that women got in that district, it's overwhelming. So this sense that this misnomer that if you can't have two women in a race because one will take votes away from the other, hopefully now should be put to bed completely, because that's not the case at all. And it hasn't been. I worked on Eileen Dunne's campaign again with Nikki Tsongas. Two women combined in that race 15 years ago got 65 or 70% of the vote. So I think people are thinking in a much more modern way about this and not in gender politics, which I think is a plus as well.
Well, that is.
And by the way, may I jump in really quickly to say something about that? Dr. Natalia Linos performed extremely well for someone who jumped in the race only a few months ago. I think, you know, we need to, she may be, you know, a rising star, because I think that her campaign impressed a lot of people. She was very thoughtful, epidemiologist, obviously running at the right moment, but she got in too late. I think if she had gotten in earlier, she would have given, you know, a real fight.
Anthony.
Yeah, I was going to jump in and say, you know, I'm always interested in terms of the positives, in what ways political campaigns improve or change or alter people who are public servants, essentially. And a couple of times I asked Markey this. I asked him this morning. I mean, in what way did this hard-fought campaign change him? And his answer basically said, I wish I had the tape for you to play, but basically he said it helped him become more attuned to this moment, this debate, this moment of movement for racial justice and so forth. His alliance with District Attorney Rachel Rollins, for example, he cited that. So when you have a hard-fought campaign like this, I think it does potentially allow folks, even people like Markey, who have been serving forever in Washington, to sort of revisit themselves and the purpose for which they are going to Washington to represent the people, and really think anew about why they're doing this. And I'd like to take him at his word that, you know, he's thinking in new ways about this moment around racial equality across the nation. So I think that's a positive. In terms of the negatives, yeah, go ahead, Scott. I'd love to know.
I agree with you. You could see that galvanize him as it went on. I mean, the last 6 days of the campaign, all he talked about was racial and economic equality. And so he really, you know, I think you could see it just in his whole thinking in terms of what the underlying key was to all the policy decisions and things that he had worked on over the years.
There's another detail I just want to throw in here, because Scott mentioned John Walsh, who was Markey's campaign manager, a terrific talent in the world of sort of political organizing. He organized Deval Patrick's first successful gubernatorial campaign. And I asked John Walsh a year ago when Kennedy got in this race, and I'll admit that I was coming at him with a little bit of a challenge. It's like, holy crap, dude, you know, Joe Kennedy is challenging your guy. I mean, this guy is young, he's handsome. I mean, you know, what are Kennedy's faults, and how are you going to go defend Markey? And Walsh looked at me and said, Joe Kennedy has no weaknesses. He's young, he's handsome, he's rich, he's a Kennedy, and he's a nice guy. You know what his problem is in this election is going to be? He's not Ed Markey. And I thought it was sort of a great answer, because it kind of, first of all, he gave me that answer without even hesitating. But he had a lot of confidence that his guy could rise to the moment, and that his job was just to ensure that voters really got to know Ed Markey. And that was Markey's big deficit going into this race. Polls showed that a lot of people didn't know who he was, in spite of the fact that he'd served so many years. And I think what Markey managed to do in the course of this campaign was convince, well, obviously he did it, to convince enough people who he was. And that's one of the reasons he won.
And you know,
so, Marcella,
I'm sorry. I was just going to ask something. The results also show him where weaknesses are for him. Absolutely, I agree that this campaign gave him an opportunity to say, this is who I am, this is what I stand for, and this is what I will do. But if you look at the results, Kennedy won in most of the gateway cities, in places where, you know, Lynn, Chelsea, Lowell, Lawrence, places where you have a lot of poverty, where you have a lot of immigrants, where you have a lot of pain right now because of the coronavirus pandemic and the economic struggles that brought. So I think there's a lesson there for him too, right? That, you know, maybe he needs to pay attention. And I'm not saying he hasn't pay attention, because he's been a leader in some of, on immigration, for instance. He has led on so many immigration policy issues, but I'd be curious as to how he approaches these places going forward.
And I think this job now.
Exactly.
You know, he spoke about racial justice in places like Hyannis and Brookline and those places where he racked up, and that's exactly where he should be talking about this stuff.
I'm going to have to wrap us there, but I am going to look forward to having the three of you in conversation again, because that was fun and interesting. That was Marcela Garcia, an editorial writer for the Boston Globe. Thanks, Marcela.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Ferson, Democratic strategist, president of the Liberty Square Group, and a paid consultant for Ed Markey's campaign. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
And WBUR's Anthony Brooks. Thanks for riding along today, Anthony.
Oh, my pleasure. It always is. Tiziana, thank you.
In any other year, that's what summer sounds like at Wally's Cafe and Jazz Club in the South End. This is one of their regular jam sessions from last July. Wally's is one of the many small venues around Greater Boston that remains closed during the pandemic. Some, like Bull McCabe's in Somerville and Bella Luna and the Milky Way in Jamaica Plain, won't reopen. So we wanted to take some time today to reflect on how and if our local music scene is weathering this storm, and to check in on a few stories that may offer hope for the future of music in our community in these turbulent times. So with us to do that is Frank Poindexter, the general manager of Wally's Cafe and Jazz Club. Frank, welcome to you.
Welcome. How are you today?
I'm great, Frank, and it's great to have you. Thank you. Also joining us is Carl Lavin, who's working to be the next owner of the now-closed Great Scott in Alston. Carl, welcome to you, too.
Thank you very much for having me. I look forward to having a chat with you guys about this.
I do, too, and I'm hoping a couple of listeners will chat with us, too. Give us a call. We want to hear from you. What are you missing? Are you missing live music right now? Do you want to share some memories of places that have closed for good, like a Bull McCabe's or Bella Luna? Are there favorite spots that you can't wait to get back to? Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, so turning to the two of you, indoor music venues remain closed. This is your livelihood. I'd like to know how you're both doing. And Frank, why don't we start with you?
Well, to be honest, it's been really difficult. We've lost about 6 months of revenue. Even more than that, we've lost the opportunity to provide these young musicians with a stage and a platform so that they can perfect and work on their craft and also create networks that's going to carry them throughout their career.
Frank, I know that you are part of a family that opened Wally's in the 1940s. I think of you as a steward of this place. As a steward, how does it feel to be in this situation?
First of all, I'm glad to be alive. But other than that, I'm not used to not working. I was telling someone the other day, my brother and I have not even taken vacations. He hasn't taken a vacation in 25 years, and I haven't taken a vacation in 16 years. That means not even leaving the city. So it's changed our whole schedule, and it's been really difficult, but even more so for the musicians.
Carl, how are you?
Well, I'm doing okay. It's of course a super challenging time for what it is that we're trying to do. It's unusual. Of course, it's completely unusual and completely unprecedented that we're trying to figure out how to go about just allowing. There's always challenges and. And the part where the challenge is even just being able to do it at all is what we're all facing right now is it's mind-boggling that that's what we're all up against, but this is what we're facing and this is what we're trying to do.
So I'm going to stay with you for a minute longer, Carl, because Great Scott announced that it would close permanently in May. Then you aligned with a crowdfunding company called Mainvest and launched an investment drive to keep it open. But then you couldn't because you couldn't reach a deal to keep the venue in its current space. Now it looks like you might be able to reopen at the old Pizzeria Regina's in Alston, which is another victim of the coronavirus pandemic. It's a kind of a crazy situation. What is the status of those negotiations now?
Yeah, it is, and as you say, it's almost mind-boggling that that the confluence of factors could allow for something to close
and then allow for something to maybe, you know, to reopen. And as far as things are right now, the landlords and the owners over there are incredibly supportive. They're very, very much on board with the idea of having everything happen over there. And now at this point, it's literally just a matter of being able to make sure that we can be on a safe and stable financial footing going forward as we, you know, as we await, you know, phase four of everything. And so we're just going to, we're just getting our financial ducks in a row and hoping that that everything can be in place when we're able to, hit the ground running.
We're going to hope for that for you too, Carl. And Frank, Wally's also launched a crowdfunding campaign. It was actually for an expansion. How is that going?
That's proceeding. And I'm probably in probably the same situation as this, as the person who was on the interview. What's his name again?
Oh, I'm Carl.
I'm sorry. Yes, Carl.
Probably in the same. We're dealing with the same type of situation. So, it's going to take time for us to actually prepare the location and. Again, the thinking about stage four, whether, you know, when is that even going to come? And then what is that going to look like? Okay. So we may get into stage four, but then that you still have to deal with the fact that you may only be able to have a third of your customers or less. And so that's a whole nother, hurdle that has to be met. So just answering your basic question, we are waiting for stage four and we're preparing ourselves so that we can continue to provide the service that we've been giving to the community for the last 73 years.
So I want to go to the calls, to the phones, because the callers are coming in. 800-423-8255. Let's take a couple here. We've got Robert from Lexington. Robert, go ahead.
Thank you very much. My girlfriend and I bemoan the loss of this and the effect on the businesses that we'll never be in again. We've become friends with a number of musicians over the years, and it's horrible for their livelihoods. We've gone on music cruises. Those are shut down because of COVID. And we are sad that there's basically no live music to go to. And with the few restaurants that have it, we have to, minimal income for them, and you have to, it's very unfortunate.
Thanks for that, Robert. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
and let's add one more call there. Let's add Omar from Quincy. Omar, go ahead.
Hey, I just happened to hear you guys on the air. Carl, this is Omar. I was in Perennials. I just wanted to say, Great Scott has been an institution in me and all of my friends' lives for the past several years, and the thought of losing it is incredibly upsetting, and I've spent so much time there, and Carl's been a great host. He's had my bands play there, and I want to give a shout-out to Wally's as well, where I've also had so many great experiences.
What a great call. Thanks, Omar. Thanks to both those callers. And I'll turn back to each of you. Carl, jump in.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that's the thing, is that, in as much as what we're facing all together right now as businesses and the industry, it's impossible to not keep at least one eye, if not both eyes, if not all of the attention on what's being lost by the fact that artists and musicians and the entire artistic community are losing these spaces. And I don't even know that it wasn't going to happen without COVID. I mean, the way things are so expensive, and the way that landlords treat artistic spaces, and the way neighborhoods treat artistic spaces has been something that's been a problem as the years have been going on anyway. And everything that's happening about this right now is exacerbating it. And I mean, my heart breaks for all of the artists and musicians who don't have a place to be able to go out and get in front of people and get that visceral experience of connecting with people who enjoy what they're doing. And so, I mean, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, for sure.
And let's bring Frank into that too, Carl. I'm just aware that we've got just a couple minutes left. Frank, join in on this and on Carl's reflections in both of those calls.
Carl hit the nail on the head. See, most people in here and in the city don't know, we have a special musical ecosystem here, which is not replicated anywhere else on the planet. We have some of the most prestigious schools for educating musicians. We got musicians that are not just local. We got musicians that are all the top musicians from across the planet or going to school to be trained. 70 to 80% of them are coming here. And so saying that, you know, the loss of these venues, you know, we're the places that help the students develop the theory that they're learning in the classrooms and stuff like that. And they go to these places like ours and they apply, they build their networks. And then, you know, we have that leads to what's going to happen 10 or 5 years, you know, down the road when they're, you know, musical directors for the large, you know, some of the top touring bands, when they're in the working for ASCAP, they're in the they're working for the record labels. This is so much stuff. It's more than just, this is a ripple effect, like Carl said. And so we have to maintain this ecosystem because it goes beyond just what we see here, okay? What you just think for a local thing. It's more than local. It's international.
Carl, I've got about 30 seconds left for each of you. So you first, Carl. What's one thing that listeners who want to make sure to support our music scene can do right now?
Oh boy! Well, you know what? Just continue to care. I mean, it's as easy as that. It's, local music is always going to find a way, and whether it's a venue or it's going to be a basement or it's going to be a house show, music is always going to find a place. It's just about how do we make sure that we are able to be able to support, amplify, and empower the artists that are just trying to make the thing about living in Boston such a unique and unique experience.
Great. And let's get one last thought on that from you, Frank.
I'm going to piggyback again off what Carl said. He explained it concisely. We have to keep caring, okay? And do that through the way that you can do it as a supporter of live music, okay? And that's what I would say.
And that is Frank Poindexter, general manager of Wally's Cafe and Jazz Club in the South End. Thank you, Frank.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Carl.
And Carl Lavin, longtime booker and possible future owner of the Great Scott in Alston. Thanks, Carl.
Thank you so much for taking an interest in this. And I please just hope everybody pays attention because it matters. I mean, this is why Boston's Boston.
Thanks. That's right. And let's go out today with where we started, music from a jam session from the summer of 2019 at Wally's. This song is There Will Never Be Another You. And that is our show for today. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston. There will never ever be, there will never ever be.